Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Yeah, we're starting a Friday with sports and politics.
Well,
isn't
hello.
That fun?
Yes, it is. I've got my sporty outfit on. I'm ready to go.
After Tiger's performance in round one of the Masters, it's hard not to talk a little bit about sports. And we would have lost money if we would have bet the over. 74.5 was what the over-under was on Tiger's round yesterday. Of course, he comes in at one under, which is just astounding given the recovery from that horrific car accident.
I mean, it was only 14 months ago. He almost lost his leg.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I missed this, I guess, in the coverage when it occurred. But my friend was telling me the Genesis SUV that he was driving actually has airbags in the driver's wheel well. And but for those airbags in the driver's wheel well, he would have lost his leg.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I guess that Genesis SUV is a sporty car, thus Tiger was driving it. But anyway, so that was cool to watch if you caught part or all of it. But I was just thinking of it watching some of the coverage yesterday, and particularly on Tiger. But, you know, the guys that are actually at the top of the leaderboard, too. It should be a great weekend of golf, as it always is in Augusta. But thinking about this in the context of men playing women's sports or women playing men's sports.
Was Annika Sorensen there?
Well, exactly. That's exactly who I was thinking of. You know, the one of the few sports where you say, well, women could compete. I mean, there are women on the LPGA that can putt as good as men on the PGA. It's probably true. I don't know if there's any statistics to back that up, but you've seen it. I mean, you've seen it in some of the tournaments where it's a male pro teamed with a female pro. I remember one last year, I think it was Bubba Watson was teamed with Julie Inkster, and Julie Inkster was lighting it up on the greens. But remember when Annika Sorenstam tried to break the ceiling, if you will, and play on the PGA Tour, played in one event, missed the cut. And it's not to say she couldn't make some cuts here and there, but Annika Sorenstam is one of the best women to ever play professional golf. And she would be, at best, a mediocre to lower-level pro if she tried to play the men's game.
Right.
We've had that admission from no less than Serena Williams on the tennis tour.
Right. I mean, that's why we have women's tees.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, especially when you're talking about the distances that that the pros play these golf courses. And so you think about non-contact sports. You say, well, okay. But it's just, it's still a different game because of the physical differences. So, yeah, and all you have to do is look at the percentages. Why would Sorenstam, who's a good ball striker and a good putter, she was a great golfer. Why would she struggle on the men's tour? Because she's hitting long irons or woods into greens where they're hitting mid irons or short irons.
Right.
And all you have to do is look at the percentages of greens in regulation based on distance and club selection, and you'll understand the advantage that provides men over women, even in a non-contact sport like golf. So all of this talk in either direction, you know, the kicker on Vanderbilt being named SEC Player of the Week because she kicked an extra point. I mean, it's all such mindless, celebratory nonsense designed to advance a political agenda, the elimination of sex, the elimination of XX and XY. Those are just starting points. That's not the end of the conversation. That's just the beginning of the conversation, your chromosomal makeup, your skeletal structure, your muscular structure. Not because if you can eliminate those things as differentials, then you can eliminate anything associated with the traditional roles men and women play in society, whether it comes to the familial roles or others, protective roles and so forth. And that's what the left aims to do, is destroy the family and any institutions that would promote the nuclear family. So this coverage from MSNBC yesterday on the topic is just so perfect, because, of course, you have what we've been talking about for some time now, a divided country. You have states moving to ban mainly men playing women's sports. But the idea is banning sports for people playing a sport that is opposed to their biological sex, and other states going in the opposite direction. So here's the MSNBC reporting on it. Reporting.
Can you talk about what other states have passed or are working on passing similar laws? We have had folks here on the show, even as recently as this week, who have talked about sort of the broad attack, as they see it, on LGBTQ plus kids in this country.
Yeah, so an NBC News analysis found that lawmakers have proposed 238 bills just this year that seek to limit the rights of LGBTQ Americans, and half of those target transgender people specifically. And 14 states total now ban transgender athletes from participating on the sports teams that align with their gender identity. So this is really part of a nationwide trend, like you mentioned.
When you look at the polling on this, right, YouGov polling from late last month, I believe it was, says that nearly half of American adults oppose trans students from playing on sports teams that match their gender identity. But when you break it down by party, I think we can show it here. It shows that more than 50% of Democrats support trans athletes playing on the gender of the sports team they identify with. 75% of Republicans oppose this. It's not surprising, I think, to see it break down on party lines, Joe, and I wonder if that matches the reporting that you've been doing.
Yeah, it definitely matches. And I think that also is because, you know, when people don't know a transgender person, they're more likely to be susceptible to misinformation or to things that, you know, aren't exactly accurate when we're talking about trans athletes. And so that's what we're seeing on, like, from Republicans, is that the Republican Party is really capitalizing, unfortunately, on people not knowing about trans people.
Yeah.
Joe Yerkeba, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
No, that's, thank you for that fine, deep dig.
That's the issue. It's a misinformation. So this is an attack launched by the left. And unsurprisingly, you have a majority of Democrat socialists who are supportive of this because, you know, they're automatons. And the commonsensical response, the parental rebellion, which is really what's driving this, because Republicans are on the, most of them are on the back of the parade on this, because they're always afraid, most are always afraid to take on these cultural issues lest they be accused of suffering from some phobia or being some being a promoter of some ism. Most Republicans are cowards. This is all initiated by the left, and the response is just commonsensical parents watching, for example, their kid at an Ivy League swim meet, their daughter swim against a dude and get lapped.
That's, and I don't believe that 50% of Democrats are, you know, pro, you know, play your sport that you identify with. I don't believe that at all, because I've seen it and I know those people, and I'm telling you, they're not happy when men showed up to play their daughters.
Yeah, well, maybe not enough of them experienced it and they're still in the virtue signaling larval stage. I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me, because they dutifully follow the cultural Marxists and whatever the media is amplifying. And this is what the media is amplifying as a nice piece of evidentiary support provided by MSNBC right there. So that's what's happening. But it is breaking down on party lines only because of a grassroots response to the inanity of the left's position, where they're, of course, projecting onto commonsensical people what they are doing. Oh, they're suffering from misinformation. We're not promoting misinformation when we say there are no physical differences between men and women as it pertains to sports, which is an argument they are continuing to make. These men and women of science on the left. Here we go again. Randy and Sandwich are on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, I wanted to share a story yesterday because your over pick that you had. I don't normally bet golf. I usually stick to the NBA. I'm like, well, Dan knows a lot about golf. I'm just going to go with his solid pick. Guaranteed lock that he just gives out on the radio that it's going to be the over. Now, here's where my ignorance came and saved me. So I'm thinking when you say over, over means better because, you know, over you get more points. And, you know, my normal sports that I bet, it's good. But then I accidentally picked under and ended up winning the bet because he ended up doing better. But I did have one quick question.
Wait, I have a question for you.
Mike
first,
Scott
Randy.
Is laughing his face off.
Randy, I have a question for you because you say you regularly bet the NBA. You lost your house betting on NBA basketball based on that story?
No, I have not because I understand that where over's better, under's better in that circumstance. But the question I had is yesterday Mike Scott said something about the Masters being a tournament where you got to be good at irons, and he picked a person that he said is really good with irons. What was the name of that guy again?
I didn't hear who Mike Scott picked. Who did he pick? Who did he pick to win?
Wait, hold on. Mike's.
I'll find out. Hold on.
Who did Mike Scott pick to win?
Mike Scott.
No, I didn't pick. Oh, yeah. I might have suggested he is one of the contenders. Yeah.
Who's that?
Hold on. I got to pull up the script. Hold on.
The man has a lot of things to memorize.
Sorry.
Well,
wait. How much money did you get, Randy?
He was saying there was an in particular person that's really good at irons in the Masters. And he said this guy,
well, they're all good.
This guy
there's about 100 of them.
Yeah, 91.
Yeah.
Randy, how much money did you bet? What was your wager?
Well, it was one unit, and my units are 100.
Units. All right, very good. Congratulations,
Randy.
What
are these units you speak of?
We'll get you Mike Scott's answer. But
I pulled it up. Hold on here.
He's a man of facts. He doesn't
Get
this
it's
wrong.
Just its computer is slow.
Let me guess. Sungjae Im.
Yeah, no, I'm not that clairvoyant.
Well, he did finish second last year, I think.
Francesco Molinari.
Right. The guy that's, five over, Colin Morikawa?
Oh, yeah. I was talking
about he had an awful first round, which is unusual for him.
Yeah, you haven't heard much from Morikawa recently, so I thought he might too. But my pick to click was Cameron Smith, so I still like Cameron Smith. And Scheffler was my backup, just because they're both so hot right now. So that's interesting. Now just to clarify, for Randy, I didn't make it my lock of the week. My lock of the week was North Carolina to cover in the championship game, which did come in. I said yesterday, I'm loath to bet against Tiger, but if I had to make the bet, I would bet the over. So that was not a very strong endorsement. I just want to, make sure people still respect and appreciate my handicapping skills. Okay. All right.
Everybody go call your bookies.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We talked yesterday about the Biden plan or lack thereof for border security with Title 42, the COVID protocol that would allow border security to expel persons coming into this country illegally. Title 42, that protocol going away. So what's the plan with the anticipated influx of illegal immigrants? And we heard yesterday about smartphones and essentially some federal version of the electronic monitoring that served Chicago so well. Meanwhile, we hear the Biden administration is moving to dispatch Veterans Affairs doctors from VA hospitals to the border to provide care for those who are ill or injured coming across the border at the expense of American veterans. Incredible.
Yeah. So they're choosing illegals over men and women who served our country and lost limbs and are sick now.
Well, that conversation continues. And, of course, that's led by Fox News' Peter Doocy, because who asks any pertinent questions at these White House press briefings other than Doocy? He's the Amy Jacobson of the Federal Press Corps. Peter Doocy asking one Jen Psaki.
Well, this is a long one, folks.
Psaki.
Hey.
About their plans.
And then on a different topic, when Title 42 expires next month, what is the plan for the 18,000 migrants a day that are going to cross? Do you want them to get jobs here? Is there something else that you want these 18,000 a day to be doing?
I don't know where you're basing your specific numbers on, Peter, but what I would tell you...
I've got it right here. Earlier this week, the department gave reporters an estimate that up to 18,000 migrants could be apprehended at the border each day if Title 42 were
being lifted. Well, up to, and we'll see what happens. And obviously we're taking steps to convey that this is not the time to come. Individuals who come to the border,
this is
what would happen. Nice. CBP and ICE would work together to ensure that anyone who enters the country without authorization is put into immigration proceedings as quickly as possible. CBP has been working with ICE to ensure individuals awaiting processing in the interior of the country would be monitored under the Alternatives to Detention Program. We know that to date, nearly 80% of non-citizens waiting in the interior under this prosecutorial discretion of either.
Then she apparently went into her sota voce. Okay, so
what is she even talking about right now?
So I love that exchange. 18,000. Where do you get that number? Department of Homeland Security. You don't know that number? Oh, well, up to 18,000. So we'll see what happens. Well, we have some good indication of what will happen, Jen, because, there were 2 million illegal border crossings last year, and the projections are this elimination of Title 42 will add another million. And then, you know, you back that number out over the course of 365 days and you come up with your number. So it's not that complicated, actually. Well, we'll see what happens. Border Patrol and ICE will do this and will do that. You have a lot of confidence that that there's a plan in place, because I'll tell you, those mayors at the in the border communities, they don't have a lot of confidence. And some Dem senators in border states that would like to get reelected, like Mark Kelly and Kyrsten Sinema, they don't have a lot of confidence. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And again, what's happening as this is happening in blue states among the Democrat socialists? What are they pushing? Moving veterans' resources to persons coming into this country illegally, giving people smartphones that we pay for so they can stay in communication with them to make sure they don't miss their hearing date. Yeah, right. In California, at the state level now, there's legislation that would allow non-citizens to become police officers.
Mm-hmm. They're desperate. They need law enforcement. First, they want to defund them and shame them.
And then replace them with people who are not American citizens.
Exactly. Bingo.
Yeah. Remove the provision, this legislation, that an individual must be a citizen or permanent resident of the United States in order to become a police officer. What do you think about that?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Because it's going to happen here. Because we're desperate for police officers here in Chicago. I mean, they've dropped so many of the restrictions and the requirements just to try and lure police or people to be, you know, take the test at least. And we can't do it.
Now, this California State Senator said the bill only allows those who are living here legally and have the legal ability to work here through a visa or green card to become police officers. I just want to be clear on that. Oh, I see. And we're supposed to trust you that law will be enforced in that way, just as the laws on the books regarding legal immigration to the United States are so enforced, just like they're enforced in California, a sanctuary state. Right, Senator? This is what they do.
State Senator Skinner.
Joe Hoffman Estates. Hey, Joe.
It turned out when Peter Ducey very first got the job, I figured just his dad got him to work and he was going to be really a nothing. He turned out to be the only real investigative reporter in that whole room.
Yep. I thought the same thing.
I'm pretty proud of that kid. Pretty and much. One more thing, just a little back to the other segment, is how in the heck are these sports bettors, I don't know what they call them, the over-under guys, how do they get this so close? It just amazes me.
It is. Yeah, they're pretty good with running the numbers and then balancing them based on where the action's coming in. Yeah, I know it. If when I wash out a radio, that's what I want to go into, being a sports handicapper.
Okay.
Diamond Dan Proft and his locks of the week. Mike in Union.
Hello.
Hey, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, how's it going? Hey, so when they're going to track all these people with their phones and ankle bracelets, are they going to, they're saying they're going to track these people. Can we count on, Tom Dart's division of ankle bracelets to track these people or noncompliance? Or is there a plan to thin out the Border Patrol and spread them throughout the United States so that they're so weak that there'll be zero enforcement? I mean, it's what a joke. Maybe Mayor Life will know, oh, don't worry, we're going to work with the administration to make sure that all these people report. It's such a setup. You guys have a good weekend.
Thanks,
yeah, and like I said yesterday, they're going to get a phone, they'll take it, and then they'll dump it because they don't want to be tracked. They don't want to. I don't know if the administration doesn't realize they don't want to go to their court hearing because they're not going to go.
Chris, Carey.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I deal in my everyday life. I deal a lot with Latin American, Hispanic, Mexicans. I got a solution. Why don't we take all the manufacturing that we do in China and move it to Mexico? Then we don't have to worry about the ports and getting stuff. Months later, it'll come across in days. We'll provide jobs to all those people who want to come here to find those jobs, and they'll stay in Mexico. I mean, I've talked to guys in the grocery industry. They like, we wouldn't come here. If we had jobs in Mexico, there'd be no reason to come. I mean, it's simple. Take all that manufacturing, move it to Mexico. Give these people reasons to stay in their country. And it's not that I don't want them here, but give them a reason to stay.
Well, it's not only Mexicans. I mean, last week, you guys, we had 3,000 Ukrainians cross the U.S.-Mexico border. It's people from all over the world.
Hey, has anybody checked in with VP Reparation H there? Has she gotten to the root causes yet?
That was one of her assignments, remember?
She worked. She got together with the Iron Triangle countries, and she's figured that out, right? The root causes of illegal immigration, so we could address the root causes and stem the flow. Anybody do a stop, look, and listen with Kamala on that? How's she doing? Jim in St. Joe, Michigan.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Great listening to you. I'm a combat veteran. My son's a combat veteran, and I just find this the lowest thing that I think our government could ever do to us. I'm fortunate that I don't have bad problems, but I've have some friends that I stay in contact with that were hurt pretty bad in combat, and it's sometimes hard for them to get their services. And then secondly, my son's wife finally came over from Japan 2 months ago, and it took her 2.5 years through all the paperwork. And this disgusts me that these people can just come across the border and just get everything free. And people here have to work hard for what they have. Thank you very much, and God bless.
Thanks, Jim. Northern Triangle countries in Central America. But, yeah, I'd love to hear an update, some sort of report from Kamala. And, to Jim's point, it's pretty straightforward. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah, and there's five Democratic senators that want to stop this.
Well, and there's... Even worse, there's senators that are aiming to start bipartisan immigration reform talks. Oh, gosh. Not another gang of 14. Tom Tillis of North Carolina, Dick Durbin, they bring together a group of senators to try to revive immigration discussions. Oh, gosh.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that spells nothing but trouble, because here's what Republicans generally do with these bipartisan negotiations. They start by conceding amnesty, and then they work down from there. I mean, they couldn't be, in terms of past history, they couldn't be more clueless when it comes to these bipartisan negotiations. You know what the bipartisan negotiation should sound like, Senator Tillis from North Carolina, since you're teaming up with Sacha Durbin on this? First thing we're going to do, we as a country cannot and will not expel every person in this country who has been convicted of a violent crime, then we have nothing to talk about. Every person in this country illegally
who has committed a crime,
who has committed a violent crime, just start there.
Okay.
I'm not willing to talk about anything. Zero. Nothing. Until you show me that you can accomplish that simple task. They're in the system, as many of them, crossing the border illegally because they're apprehended and then released into the country, as happened 600,000 times last year. And then they're in the system again because they're prosecuted and convicted of a violent crime. And then they're still in this country. We know this happens from going back to the Obama years and Ted Cruz's interaction with immigration enforcement directors of the Obama administration, the first two terms of Joe Obama. Hundreds of thousands of times, convicted murderers, convicted rapists, drunk drivers, and so forth. If you're convicted of a felony and you're still in this country illegally, you got to go. And if the federal government can't do that, then I don't have faith they'll do anything else, and I'm not interested in talking about anything else. How about that as an opener from Republicans? And then we can build from there, because I'm a proponent of legal immigration. And I think immigration should be made more efficient so that good people who want to come to this country and add to this country and assimilate in this country to be Americans, like has happened through every generation of Americans, let's do it. But I'm not going to do it if you're running through the back door what you can't get through the front door. We're closing the back door. So we start there, and nothing else shall be discussed. You can raise whatever issue you want, Sacha Durbin, and the chorus from the GOP caucus will be not interested until you do this. Keep people's attention focused on first principles, the basics, rather than having the conversation diluted because there's 42 proposals on 42 different aspects of our Byzantine immigration law. Verlon, Southside.
The answer to immigration isn't to give up our jobs and make us more dependent on the government, because they'll find another reason to come here. It's because of their standard of life, drug cartels and whatever abuses some come over here for. You know, so and then replacing American citizens with illegals, that's just another a reason for them to dilute law and order here. That's the agenda, to dilute law and order here. So I don't think the other caller was on point with giving up American jobs to try to keep them over in Mexico. Just keep them out. Follow the rule of law that we have here and keep them out and let them go through the regular process. Just like Donald Trump said, do it the right way.
Yeah, and thanks for the call, Verlon. And I'd be open to a guest worker program to do it the right way, to make sure that we have some sort of legal regime associated with people who just want to come here to work and then go home. Okay, I mean, and that fills a need given right. The 12 million unfilled jobs in America, particularly in the manufacturing sector. Okay, let's talk about that. But I'm not willing to talk about it until you expel people convicted of felonies who are in this country illegally. If we can't agree on that baseline, then we have nothing to talk about. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. You know, in 1900, there was the Boxer Rebellion in China.
Yeah.
And the Fists of Righteous Harmony, the people there just rebelled against foreign influence is what they did. But I think to a certain extent, they were also rebelling against their own treasonous government. The you know, China had their Dowager Empress, Qi Ji, and various other mandarins in the government were just sellouts and traitors to foreign interests and really corporate interests from the British and others and so forth. That's what we have. We have a Dowager Empress in Joe Biden. And I think it was Brian Lonergan had a good article in American Greatness yesterday about these policies are absolutely treasonous, that they are, you know, designed to hurt the American people. That's what it certainly seems like, and that's what he was arguing in that article. So I don't know how we get out of this. So.
Yeah, I mean, Frank, spoiler alert here, but tell us how that Boxer Rebellion ended for the Boxers.
Well, the Marines and the British had the Sikh troops come in and put them down.
Yeah.
So didn't end up well.
No.
No doubt. But you just try and look at what these...
The basis of the rebellion.
What the basis of the rebellion is. And the people that were very mad. And look what's happened. And I've argued this before on here. What's happened to China over 150-year time period is in many respects similar to what's been happening to our country over the last 30 years in terms of our leadership.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the Institute for Political Skullduggery, that professional liar and red diaper baby David Axelrod runs at the University of Chicago.
Wow, that was an impressive description.
Thank you very much.
Wow, all in one breath?
They had a little symposium the other day.
Yeah. They wouldn't take questions about Hunter Biden.
Well, they
did.
They did take questions about him. The answers were particularly revealing, I thought, and congratulations to some of these University of Chicago freshmen who pressed the members of these august panels at this summit on the issue of the media's coverage of that topic as well as others. Here's one, Daniel Schmidt, pressing The Atlantic's Ann Applebaum.
Amazing. Thank you. Thank you for doing this. Really appreciate it. I'm Daniel Schmidt. I'm a freshman at the University of Chicago. My question is for Ms. Applebaum. So in 2020, you wrote, those who live outside the Fox News bubble do not, of course, need to learn any of the stuff about Hunter Biden, referring to his laptop, of course. A poll later after that found that if voters knew about the content of the laptop, 16% of Joe Biden voters would have acted differently. Now, of course, we know a few weeks ago, the New York Times confirmed that the content is real. Do you think the media acted inappropriately when they instantly dismissed Hunter Biden's laptop as Russian disinformation? And what can we learn from that in ensuring that what we label as disinformation is truly disinformation and not reality?
I mean, my problem with Hunter Biden's laptop is I think totally irrelevant. I mean, it's not whether it's disinformation or, I mean, I don't think the Hunter Biden's business relationships have anything to do with who should be president of the United States. So I don't find it to be interesting. I mean, that would be my problem with that as a major news story.
We're going to talk about more of this tomorrow.
Oh, uh-huh. Yeah.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Such a telling comment from Ann Applebaum. It's not important. Story's not important. I don't find it interesting, therefore it's not newsworthy.
It's not important what I think, because I don't think anything of it.
It's funny, too, that she says it's not an important story. It has no bearing, should have no bearing on electing a president, because Ann Applebaum tweeted back in March of 2019 when there were all sorts of assertions being made in the direction of Trump and Russian collusion, including that Trump was engaged in secret business dealings with Putin. That was, remember, one of the legs of the Russian collusion stool. And Applebaum tweeted at the time, if the pursuit of a secret business deal in a foreign country while running for president doesn't violate any laws, then maybe it should. Huh. So, Ann, is that still your position? Because the Hunter Biden laptop story is interesting to some. Not you. No, we got it. Not you. Not interesting, not relevant. But it was relevant to the Ann Applebaum of 2019 if you apply the same facts. So if there was a situation, Ann, where Donald Trump Jr. was doing a business deal with a Chinese communist-backed business enterprise, and there was a suggestion that Donald Trump Jr. was cutting in, let's say, the big guy for 10%, and that big guy turned out to be his father, would that be interesting to you?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Would that be newsworthy to you, you think? Is that germane to electing a president, I wonder? Jonah Goldberg was one of the panelists. Jonah Goldberg, formerly of National Review, now over at the Bulwark, I guess. You know, and Jonah Goldberg's been on this show many times and talked to him many times before when I was at WLS. And I like him. He's a smart guy. He's a creative writer. He's funny. But he is one of the casualties of Trump derangement syndrome, because what you're about to hear from Jonah Goldberg yucking it up with these red diaper babies and skullduggerous leftists at David Axelrod's little sinecure at University of Chicago is rather remarkable, I think. Almost as remarkable as what Ann Applebaum said. Jonah Goldberg on this assertion that if people knew about the Hunter Biden laptop story, then it could have altered the 2020 election.
We talk about A to C. They now think that if only the media had told us about the laptop at the time, as the kid yesterday was suggesting, which I don't buy his, you know, theory, that Trump would have won. You know, but for the censoring of the New York Post, Trump would have won. And I think it's a preposterous counterfactual, but it's also it's impossible for me to refute. In the same way, I cannot refute that this bottle is keeping all the polar bears away. Right? I mean, do you see any polar bears? Right? I cannot prove the negative. And this is just it has now become.
Can we lock the doors just in case?
It has been wrapped into a much larger narrative. And so when they hear disinformation, they say, oh, you mean like Hunter laptop, which actually turned out to be true?
Well, I don't know if Trump would have won, but it proves that the media is in bed with the Democratic Party.
Well, then it was misinformation and censorship to protect the misinformation campaign. Number one, that you would think as a erstwhile conservative would be concerning to Jonah Goldberg. Apparently it's not. In addition, as Daniel Schmidt correctly pointed out, there was a survey taken, and there's another one I'll get to in a second. 16% of Joe Biden voters would have voted differently, they say, if Hunter Biden laptop story was not suppressed. That was put out, a survey that was done by the Media Research Center. So, you know, 16%. I don't know what the distribution of that is across the states, you know, where that would have made a difference or not made a difference. So I can't say it either. But it's not so easily dismissed as Goldberg holding up a bottle of water and saying, I can't prove that this is not keeping the polar bears out of this classroom because, you know, you can't prove the negative. That's a germane fact. And it calls into question the legitimacy of the D.C. press corps based on what they did and based on the market research that we've received in terms of how that would have impacted the vote. Attorney General Barr, who has not been afraid to be critical of Trump, suggests the otherwise. Now, is he a crank too? Attorney General Barr, William Barr, saying in an interview recently, per his book tour, that he believes that the suppression of the New York Post story on the Hunter Biden laptop did cost Trump the election. I'm not saying it did or didn't, because Joan Goldberg's right in the sense of, unless you really dig into the numbers at a granular level to see which voters would have been moved in which states and how that would have impacted the outcome in those states, I can't say that. I'm happy to be restrained on the topic, but it's not to be waved off, and it's not to be treated as some sort of howling at the moon because Jonah Goldberg doesn't like Donald Trump. That's embarrassing. Oh, by the way, the other survey I mentioned, Rasmussen, this just recently, last month, actually. Oh, and, you know, please, Ann Applebaum, I hope this doesn't distress you. 1,000 U.S. voters polled by Rasmussen, 66% believe the Hunter Biden laptop story is important. Another 48% say it's very important. Only 15% of those polled say the contents of the Hunter Biden laptop are not important at all. So Ann Applebaum doesn't think it's relevant. One of the D.C. press corps gatekeepers over at The Atlantic, you know, in service of Mrs. Jobs. She doesn't think it's important. Two-thirds of the public, per this Rasmussen survey, do. Nearly half say it's very important. Only one in six say it's not important. But, of course, the one in six includes all the members of the D.C. press corps, and so the limited coverage on the story.
But she sounds like such an elitist snob, the way she answered that question, too.
Oh, completely.
God.
That's who they are. That's who they are.
Next question, please.
Yeah. Let them eat synthetic beef. I mean, that's the attitude.
It's
absolutely. That's right. And Jonah Goldberg's playing right in. So, you know, I don't know. So he can continue to, you know, enjoy support as a legitimate, certified conservative by the David Axelrods and the Ann Applebaums of the world. Maybe he can get his columns printed at The Atlantic, too. How embarrassing. What a sellout. And I'm loath to say that because I really like Jonah Goldberg, but those comments, particularly at that venue, are ridiculous. Speaking of ridiculous, the left's magic cue ball, Brian Stelter, was there from CNN. Yeah. And
we could have had him over for lunch.
Yeah, I'm sorry we couldn't book him for you for our enjoyment. I would love to talk to him because he wouldn't get away with what he got away with at that forum. Another great young man. Love this. It's nice to see a couple of University of Chicago freshmen speaking truth to power. His name is Christopher Phillips, and he challenged Brian Stelter on the media's coverage, not limited to the Hunter Biden laptop. Now, listen to what he said, the young man. Listen to the left's magic cue ball's answer and what he gets away with.
Hi, thank you for coming. My name is Christopher Phillips. I'm a first year at the college. My question is for Mr. Stelter. You've all spoken extensively about Fox News being a purveyor of disinformation, but CNN is right up there. They push the Russian collusion hoax. They push the Jussie Smollett hoax. They smeared Justice Kavanaugh as a rapist, and they also smeared Nick Salmon as a white supremacist. And yes, they dismissed the Hunter Biden laptop affair as pure Russian disinformation. Mainstream corporate journalists becoming little more than apologists and cheerleaders for the regime. Is it time to finally declare that the canon of journalistic ethics is dead?
Why are we losing our audio?
All the mistakes of the mainstream media, and CNN in particular,
hey.
Are we expected to believe that this is all just some sort of random coincidence, or is there something else behind it?
It's too bad. It's time for lunch.
You have 30 seconds.
No, I mean, there's a clock that says 30 seconds. But I think my honest answer to you, and I'll come over and talk in more detail after this, is that I think you're describing a different channel than the one that I watch. But I understand that that is a popular right-wing narrative about CNN. I think it's important when we talk about shared reality and democracy. All these networks, all these news outlets have to defend democracy. And when they screw up, admit it. But when Benjamin Hall, the Fox correspondent, was wounded in Ukraine, the news crews at CNN and the New York Times stopped what they were doing, and they tried to help. They tried to help him get out of the country. They tried to find the dead crew members. That's what news outlets do.
So you heard him run through the University of Chicago undergrad, run through Smollett, Sandman, Russian collusion, Hunter Biden. And the response you get from the magic cue ball is that's a popular right wing narrative. That's not the channel that I watch. And then he goes off on this tangent about how news crews in a theater of war helped an injured reporter from Fox News. What the hell? I mean, that's great that they did, but what the hell does that have to do with the conversation? Zero. And by the way, that's not a popular right-wing narrative. That's CNN's actual reporting. You know, that's why CNN settled with Nick Sandman in his defamation case, Magic Cue Ball, isn't it? That is what the reporting was initially on Jussie Smollett when he alleged this hate crime, isn't it, Magic Cue Ball? Can you want us to pull and run clips for you to refresh your recollection? Do you want us to pull and run clips of Russian collusion stories CNN put out that had to be retracted, Magic Cue Ball? We could do that. And we could do the same for the Hunter laptop story, and we could do the same for myriad other stories CNN covered. And he gets away with this. That's a popular right-wing narrative. We just get to dismiss. Annie Applebaum, it's not an important story because I don't find it important, even though if you applied the same fact pattern to the Trump family, it would be important. And Stelter, vast right-wing conspiracy, right-wing propagandizing. That's your D.C. press corps. And to that young man, Mr. Phillips' comment, is it time to recognize that the corporate media is not in the business of news reporting, that they have no ethical standards and they deserve no trust? The answer is simply yes, it is time. And by the way, it's embarrassing, again, going back to Jonah Goldberg, since, as far as I know, he was the token center-right panelist during this Institute for Skullduggery conference. It's embarrassing that he didn't take the time to say that. Further embarrassing. Brian in St. John, Indiana.
Hey, good morning. Happy Friday. Did you notice that Christopher Phillips said he was a first year at the University of Chicago? Is it frowned upon to use the word freshman now at
yeah,
the University
right.
of Chicago?
I'm sure
but
it is.
But nonetheless, I went to, before I was a pipe fitter, I went to school at Eastern Illinois, and I got my degree in journalism back in 06. And before the 2020 election, I reached out to one of my old professors that I, you know, I really looked up to, and I asked her if she thought the if the media treated Trump fairly. And she had told me that they did, and that she got her news from Washington Post and CBS. So that's who I learned from, apparently. But real quick, is 81 million, 16% is nearly 13 million votes. So I would imagine that there was a decent possibility that they're dismissing. They're so arrogant that there would be a possibility that, Biden did not win the election. That's all I got. Happy Friday. Bye.
Thanks for the call, Brent. Yeah, I mean, they like the outcome, so they dismiss any questions about the election. And anybody who questions them are smeared as propagating right-wing narratives. They're white nationalists. They're conspiracy theorists. Really? We're just looking at survey data. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for this segment. I caught parts of it last night. I'm wondering if the audio or the video is available on YouTube. Yeah. This just shows how sad the news media is. I'm one of those that believes the media spun the narrative with Biden and protecting him. And this particular segment with Ann Applebaum and a few others just shows the sad state of journalism and how they're to this day even spinning the narrative on Biden, trying to protect him. And hopefully they're going to dig into the laptop.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Dmitry Peskov is Putin's mouthpiece. He was on Sky News talking about the casualties the Russian military forces have suffered and fainting interest in peace, saying the following.
You've lost thousands of troops. How many troops
yes,
have you lost?
We have significant losses of troops, and it's a huge tragedy for us. Now, about two regions, Kiev and the Chernigov regions. So actually, the troops were really withdrawn from that region as an act of a goodwill during the negotiations between two delegations, Russian and Ukrainian delegation. And it was an act of a goodwill just to lift tension from those regions, and in order to show that Russia is really ready to create comfortable conditions for continuation of negotiations.
Yeah,
for more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Noah Rothman. He is Commentary Magazine and associate editor for Commentary Magazine, I should say, and author of Unjust Social Justice and the Unmaking of America, that is. Noah, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So how should we read what's coming out of the Kremlin, as it were, from Mr. Peskov, where he acknowledges the losses and, of course, says that's a tragedy. At the same time, he doesn't indicate that we won't send more Russian soldiers to their deaths in Ukraine, while at the same time, again, suggesting that the Russians are interested in some sort of peace settlement, and they've indicated as such through some troop pullbacks.
Well, I'm not sure how interested they are in a settlement at this stage, but that is a very significant admission. Until now, they've been downplaying or not acknowledging or refuting even reports of the extent of Russian casualties, particularly in and around Kyiv. And this is a big admission that they are suffering significant casualties. It's a sort of a crack in what had been a united front of misinformation, disinformation coming out of the Kremlin, an acknowledgement of our shared reality. That is interesting. It doesn't to me suggest anything other than the acknowledgement that the world has now seen that they've pulled back entirely from this very costly assault on the Russian capital and in the city of Chernihiv. And those were very strategic objectives. They are out of reach for this campaign. They have now changed the strategic objectives to be eastern Ukraine, which is a big diminution of what they wanted to do. They wanted to break this country, capture it, install a new government, break its national identity, and reintegrate it into the Russian sphere. That is not achievable anymore.
And do we have a handle on the losses suffered by Ukraine? Because I haven't seen much reporting other than sort of individual anecdotal reporting on the losses, the civilians that have been killed, as well as some Ukrainian military. But I don't really get a handle on the proportion here.
Yeah, I don't know if I can put a finer point in it either. We have very firm numbers coming out of the Kremlin and the Ministry of Defense in Ukraine, neither of which I'm prepared to accept at face value. The Ministry of Defense in the UK does some pretty well-informed guesses, but they're only that. And there's no estimates as to civilian casualties. They're in the tens of thousands. But Russian military casualties, roughly 10,000 last I checked, and I think that was a week ago, in men alone, not material. Which have been also significant losses. And that's roughly the decimation, 1 out of 10 Russian soldiers in this invasion force, which is, you know, includes not only combat personnel but support personnel. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you have a plan that requires 10 men and the 10th man is gone, the plan doesn't work anymore. You have to create a whole new plan, which
well,
is essentially what we've seen Moscow do.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, the reason I ask about the Ukrainian forces and where they currently stand in terms of manpower and the fact that we can't seem to get a handle on that. If this is going to be some extended war of attrition, which essentially is what General Milley said before the House Armed Services Committee this week, that this is going to be measured in at least years, then don't we have to have some sort of assessment on who is more well positioned to survive that war of attrition?
Yeah, well, we've seen every indication that there's an imbalance of forces here, not on the side of Russia, but on the side of Ukraine, a favorable imbalance, not because they have more men at arms. They do not. They have a civilian population that has demonstrated repeatedly, not just throughout this conflict, but in prior conflicts, certainly in this one, a willingness to resist violently and for the foreseeable future. We've seen videos and images of average Ukrainians shooting on Russian columns approaching cities from windows, you know, citizens driving by a Russian position and throwing Molotov cocktails at them. That's the occupation that Moscow is facing. And that's why, if this is measured in years, the assumption is that Moscow continues to drive into Ukraine, secure whatever strategic objectives it can in the east, and maintain its position, secure its position. But a restive population will, of course, make that a very difficult proposition. And it's not a sustainable one in perpetuity. It's not one unless you pacify this population in the ways that we've seen Russia try to do it, which is incredibly bloody, spectacularly brutal, and an offense to our understanding of what the rules of war are, these evacuations, quote unquote, of civilian populations in occupied cities like Melitopol and around Mariupol back into Russia proper, where these people are suddenly surface on videos where they say, oh, we're being treated very well, and maybe even Ukraine bombed itself. I mean, that's the kind of conduct that we don't see in modern warfare anymore, and it's the sort that I think Russia is predisposed to engage in eastern Ukraine, which will only cement its position as a pariah state in the international environment. It will make it impossible to relieve sanctions, which the West desperately wants to do. They're very uncomfortable with the sanctions regime they've had to impose on Moscow, but they've been stalwart in imposing it. And it will perpetuate the conflict in Ukraine. So, yeah, we're facing down the barrel of a decade-long conflict, at least. But it's one that there's no prospect for Moscow to win if the civilian population continues to resist as they have. It's just a matter of time before they come to the conclusion in the Kremlin that their strategic objectives are out of reach. And once they reach that conclusion, we can achieve something looking like a lasting settlement.
Hi, Noah. Amy Jacobson here. How are you?
Hi, Amy.
Hi.
I'm well. How are you?
Good. So what, if anything, does it mean? Well, Noah and I go back a ways. We had lunch together once at one of our freedom summits, remember?
Oh, memories.
See, memories.
Light the corners of my eyes. Yeah.
Back in the day.
I did. I think that was 5 years ago now, though.
I know. That time flies. So what, if anything, does it mean that Russia was suspended from the UN Human Rights Council?
Not a lot, frankly. The UN Human Rights Council should be disbanded, and the earth upon which it sits should be salted, never to be used again for human activity. It is a terrible organization. It exists primarily to demonize Israel and to shield the world's human rights abusers from the consequences of their actions. They sit on this council. Nikki Haley, when she was UN ambassador, withdrew the United States from this organization. Good for her. She should have, and the United States should have never returned to it. Every institution that is operated and maintained by the UN General Assembly is a rogue institution. The UN General Assembly is not worth the paper its charter is printed on, and only the UN Security Council has any viability as an instrument of international security, and on it sits a permanent member, Russia, and there is no mechanism for getting them out of that. They inherited by default the Soviet Union's seat, and there's no way to get them out of it. So, yeah, I have very little respect for the United Nations and its institutions, and certainly very little expectation that removing Russia from one of these organizations will have any effect on its international standing.
And among the two dozen countries that voted against removing them from the Human Rights Council, China and Iran. I certainly hope that Iran's vote against removing Russia from the Human Rights Council doesn't impact our willingness to provide a glide path for a nuclear Iran.
I'm almost 100% sure that the new talks around a new Iran deal are dead. Not because we don't want them desperately, and not because Iran doesn't want them desperately, but because of Russia. We need Russia to make this deal work. In Vienna, Moscow is still a member in good standing of the Community of Nations because they are so desperately needed to ink this deal. And because not only we need them to take Iran's fissile material, that's their part of the bargain. And Russia doesn't really want sanctions relief against Iran. They would like it for themselves, to engage in bilateral trade. But they don't want Iranian oil flooding the market right now. They need as high a price for their commodities as possible. And to relieve the sanctions on Iranian oil would just depress the price of oil. So things got a little sticky around sanctions relief for Moscow in negotiations, and it just stuck there. And frankly, at this point, with the progress that Iran is making towards a fissionable device, I don't know how much time there is left to negotiate them out of it. We may be looking more at a strategy of containing an inevitably nuclearized Iran.
And speaking of Iran, the report out yesterday, two U.S. soldiers were injured in shelling at a Air Force base in the Green Village in Syria. Iran-backed militias are allegedly the responsible party. So here again, I mean, as you were just describing, our desire to do this deal with Iran, to resuscitate this deal, in spite of the relationship with Russia, in spite of Iran's posture towards the U.S. presence in the Middle East.
And we're going to see more activity from Iranian proxies, Shia militias around the Middle East, and perhaps its most active proxy that we don't really talk about very much as an Iranian proxy, the Houthi militia that is in control of Yemen.
Right.
That routinely fires on not just the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, but targets inside the United Arab Emirates, where American forces are stationed. It's pretty plain that their targets are Western interests to attract Western attention to bog the United States down in a conflict, a proxy conflict in the Middle East, and to attrit America's capacity, public opinion's capacity to tolerate deployments in the region that Iran hopes to dominate. So yeah, we should expect to see more activity from them, more violent activity, and perhaps even Americans in the crossfire. That is the intention of this campaign.
Earlier this week, ABC News' Stephen Portnoy put this question to White House spokesman Jen Psaki about the atrocities committed by Putin's forces in Ukraine. And he said, you know, essentially, isn't it time for the U.S. to lead a worldwide war against Russia? And she dutifully deflected that question. So, you know, no troops on the ground and so on and so forth. What's your response to that question? And also, what does that question tell you about the disposition of the D.C. press corps?
Well, I suppose it's a question that has to be asked, because it's being asked. It's being asked of respondents to polls. It's being talked about on Sunday shows. So it's something in the ether. Our responsible policymakers should make it quite plain that if public opinion was in favor of a no-fly zone, for example, over Ukraine, then public opinion is wrong, and that you cannot be given that which you want, because what you want is catastrophic. Public opinion doesn't necessarily track with good policy. And that's something that we, as who elect representatives to government, we're not a pure democracy. We elect representatives with the understanding that they will represent our interests as best they can. And our interests do not include a shooting war with Russia. They won't at any point. Moreover, that would be a lifeline to Moscow. Part of the reason why we're seeing such morale problems on the Russian side is because they're fighting against a brethren nation, a nation that is similar in culture and values and language. And there's very little interest in bombing Ukraine out of existence, except among a very nationalistic sort that doesn't believe Ukraine as a nation should exist. Now, if we were to engage, if this became a war against NATO or a proxy war against NATO, even though it is that, but if that became the understanding, it would help cement public opinion in favor of this campaign. It would probably help Russia figure out some of its strategic and tactical issues, because their war plan against Ukraine apparently does not exist, as we can see from operations on the ground. But a war plan against NATO most certainly does. And they know how to fight that war. They know how to fight that war with their eyes closed. So it's not something that we should be giving them the opportunity to engage with, a favorable narrative, a campaign against the West. Right now, the narrative is not favorable to Moscow. It is a campaign against a former Soviet state with many Russian ethnic Russians and Russian speakers. That's what's confounding the situation for Moscow, and we shouldn't give them a lifeline out of it.
He is Noel Rothman, associate editor for Commentary Magazine, author of Unjust Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. Noah, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about atrocities in Ukraine. How about atrocities here in the United States, in the nation's capital? This story out of Washington, D.C., that was generated by a rather interesting group called Progressive Anti-Abortion Uprising. These are atheists and leftists who are also pro-lifers.
And if you want to see the press conference, it's on YouTube, and you can watch the entire thing. And we'll explain here what they did.
They received fetuses from a whistleblower from within a local abortion clinic. And then they privately arranged for the D.C. Metropolitan Police homicide unit to pick up five recently discovered late-term aborted babies for forensic examination to see if these were, in fact, victims of infanticide and even, obviously, murder is a violation of the local law, but also a violation of federal law with respect to late-term abortions.
Basically, they talked to one of the truck drivers who was taking away medical waste, and they asked him, you know, his position, like, do you know what you're taking away? And he gave them the medical waste, which was labeled medical waste, and it was babies.
And Lila Rose over at Live Action posted the pictures of the dead children. It's just chilling, gruesome stuff. It's interesting. We have a D.C. press corps that will post the graphic images of civilians killed in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm, but they
won't. And I understand why. I'm not disagreeing with that, to bring the reality of war home, but not the reality of abortion home here in the United States. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Christina Bennett, who's a Live Action News correspondent. Christina, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for discussing this topic.
And so after what Amy and I were just describing occurred, the response from federal law enforcement was to arrest the whistleblower.
Right. So there are some charges that one of the activists are facing. They're somewhat related to some past things with a clinic. They do different rescues with the clinic. And so when they called the D.C. police, that caused them to investigate more. And now one of the activists, pro-life activists, is facing charges. So we'll see what happens. But hopefully those charges will be cleared and she'll be free.
What kind of charges? Like, what exactly is she facing?
You know, they know best, the Progressive Anti-Abortion Uprising, but it's not related to this exact situation. They do different rescues, and it's related to a previous rescue.
Yeah, but so the response from federal law enforcement and local law enforcement is, you know, maybe we'll investigate if there's more information that's provided, but we will investigate the whistleblower and we'll see if we can identify any possibility to bring charges against the whistleblower. That's the law enforcement response in this case to date.
Correct. Yeah. And it's so wrong, because what's happening here is you've got Dr. Santangelo, who's the one who's committing murder, who's committing likely partial birth abortion, who Live Action has caught on camera literally saying that if a baby was born alive after an abortion, he would not help that baby. And he's free and he's innocent. And to many people, he'd be considered a hero, when really he's the one that should be facing criminal charges for his actions.
It gets even more gruesome than that. As Amy was just describing, this medical waste company, Curtis Bay Medical Waste Services in Baltimore, Maryland, they originally had on their website that they use medical waste to generate electricity.
Yes.
And then when this was raised by pro-life groups, that you have a medical waste company that is, I mean, I don't know how else to say it. Being a medical waste company that is essentially suggesting they burn aborted babies to generate electricity, and they're touting this as a value add for their company, they removed that statement from their website.
It's absolutely disgusting and horrifying, and I know it's hard for people to even believe it's happening, but this is the reality of abortion. They are burning babies to create energy, to create electricity. And these are the hidden horrors of the abortion industry that the American public does not know. and they need to know, because this is happening every day in our country, and it's hidden, and it's disgusting and evil.
And there have been some calls by members of Congress for an investigation, some pressure that is attempting to be applied to local police in D.C. to investigate at least these five preborn children who were murdered, right?
Absolutely. Over 23 members of Congress signed a letter calling for the D.C. mayor, calling for the medical examiner, calling for the police to investigate. We're asking for an autopsy. We need to know if these children were killed because of an illegal partial birth abortion. And we've had medical professionals look at the photos, and they believe that this is the case. And so we are calling, and thankfully members of Congress are calling as well, for an investigation and for an autopsy.
And has there been any response from police or the coroner's office about that request for an autopsy?
Unfortunately, they have not been willing to do that. But we are continuing to ask people to call the D.C. mayor's office and to call the D.C. medical examiner's office and demand that they would do that.
Do you know
why wouldn't they do it? What's their explanation?
I think that they don't want to look at the reality of what's happening. And they don't probably want to investigate this abortionist, because most likely if they did, they would find probably more hidden horrors. I can imagine. I can give a similar example with Dr. Kermit Gosnell, who is now in jail for life.
Yeah.
He wasn't investigated. Over and over again, people looked at his clinic and they just looked the other way. And it wasn't until he was found guilty selling narcotics that's how he ended up going to jail. But for years, people overlooked the fact that he had a dirty clinic, that he was abusing women, that women had died, that he was keeping fetal remains in little refrigerators and stuff down the toilet. I mean, it's really some disgusting house of horror stuff. But he got away with it for so long because the authorities looked the other way. And that's what's happening now. They're looking the other way, and they're not investigating Dr. Santangelo, and they're not giving an autopsy for these children like we're demanding them to do.
Has anyone tried to reach out to the doctors who are performing these abortions? Do you know their names? Do you know who they are?
Well, in this particular situation, it's Dr. Santangelo. He is the doctor at the Washington Clinic in D.C., the surgery center, and he's been the main doctor for over 20 years. And we've done investigations as Live Action where we've caught him on camera. But aside from that, he's not really able to be reached.
Yeah, I just met besides him, there are other people that are working there, too, at the clinic.
Do you mean people inside trying to reach him?
Yes, that's what I meant.
I'm not sure if anyone's trying to reach him inside. I hope and pray so, but I don't know.
You know, you keep talking about the reality of this gruesome industry and the ghouls within the industry. Obviously, we've had some wonderful conversion stories like Abby Johnson, who used to run a Planned Parenthood clinic and now is a pro-life heroine. But it's Kermit Gosnell, and there was a movie made about this, and our friend Andrew Klavan wrote the screenplay and so forth. So that brought some profile to it. I mean, even here closer to home in Chicago, we had this case of this Indiana abortionist named Ulrich Klopfer, who after his death, authorities found 2,411 medically preserved fetus remains at his home.
Oh, that's right.
And his office
and a farm too.
And so it's because we collectively turn a blind eye to the horrors, as you were just suggesting in this case and in the Gosnell case and in the Klopfer situation, we allow these horrors to persist.
We do, and really, this is a part of our nation. This is a part of America that so many people, even people of faith, are unwilling to really reckon with, unwilling to really look at. And it's tragic because if you think about what happened with Nazi Germany, if you think about what happened in the days of slavery, afterwards, people get the full story. And sometimes they see what's happening during it, but then afterwards with Nazi Germany, it's like, I didn't know. They were doing these experiments. This was happening. And it's so grotesque and it's so shocking. And people regret that they didn't do more. And so now we're in this situation right now where we don't want, you know, 10, 20, 30 years from now, all of this to come to the surface and people say, why didn't we do anything? Why didn't we stand up for these preborn children? And so we're trying to speak out as much as we possibly can to let people know this is happening right now and we have to do something about it because it's really a stain on our beautiful nation.
Are any lawmakers supporting you and helping you?
we definitely have pro-life lawmakers and legislators, like the ones who signed that letter from Congress, who support us, who share our information, who stand with us, and they are a great encouragement to us. You know, we wish that every single legislator, every single elected official would stand with us. That's not the case, but we're really thankful for the pro-life ones that do.
Mm-hmm. This organization that brought this to the public's attention, this progressive anti-abortion uprising, this is rather interesting because, of course, the pro-life movement is caricatured by the D.C. press corps as just a bunch of right. Bible Belt evangelicals or conservative Catholics, that this is all about imposing some sort of theocracy on America and so on and so forth. And in point of fact, here you have a bunch of atheist leftists who also recognize that this is a barbaric practice.
Yes, it's run by a woman named Teresa who is an atheist, and she's very vocal about being an atheist. But she was challenged at one point before she was pro-life because she was for animal rights, and someone challenged her and said, how can you be for animal rights and so supportive of animal rights when you don't care about preborn babies? And she thought, oh, well, that's not the same thing. And then she really thought about it and looked into it, and she realized it is the same thing. And so she dedicated her life to fighting to save lives for the ending of abortion. And her, along with, there's another organization called Secular Pro-Life. They are groups of people who, like you said, are atheists, they're liberals, they're progressive, but they believe that the preborn child has dignity, has worth, and has value, and they're against dismemberment. They're against murder. And what I love about their groups and what they stand for is that we should all be against murder of preborn children. It shouldn't be controversial.
No,
it's very simple.
Well, I mean, it's rather ironic because back in the day when the partial birth abortion legislation first was making its way through Congress, the vote in the U.S. Senate, and this is at a time when Hillary Clinton and Ted Kennedy were still there, was, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, 94-0.
Mm-hmm.
And yet here we are still fighting these fights for the protection of babies in the third trimester, abortion, live birth abortions, protecting them outside of the womb even from the pro-abortionists on the the pro-abortionists, I guess, across the political spectrum, because it's not limited to one side.
Yes, and I think the challenging thing is that you can pass legislation, and it's wonderful when that happens, but if you're not holding these abortionists accountable, then they can do whatever they want behind closed doors. And so if these activists had not stopped the Curtis Bay Medical Waste guy and said, hey, can we have that box of babies, then we wouldn't have known about this. I mean, of course, we would know that this is happening across the country, but this particular case, we wouldn't have even known. And so how many times has this company come and got a box like that? And how many other babies perhaps have died from a partial birth abortion or a late-term abortion? And even though we have this ban, if these doctors are not being held accountable, if they're not being investigated, they're getting away with murder. They're breaking the laws, and they're not being held accountable.
And you have Jeff Bezos' ex-wife who gives Planned Parenthood $375 million.
Ooh. And tragic.
That's why that industry has so much political power, because they have so many rich leftists behind them, and of course behind the politicians that are behind them as well. And that this is why these horrors go unchecked.
Yes, and they get a lot of money from our government as well, and our taxpayer dollars. I live in the state of Connecticut, and 70% of the abortions here are paid for by our taxpayer dollars. And that's tragic, because I don't want my money going towards the murder of children, but it is, tragically. And that's happening in many places across the country, and of course, from our federal government, and we need to stop. We need to defund Planned Parenthood. We shouldn't be giving them our money so that they can kill children.
We know that in Illinois, and we had a Republican governor who made Illinois an abortion on demand state all 9 months, and a state that is afflicted with abortion tourism because the law is so lax here as compared to our neighbors. We know it all too well. Christina Bennett, Live Action News correspondent. Christina, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me and for talking about this subject.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information. to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Big news this week that Triple Threat and the city are moving to offer reimbursement to businesses who set up security cameras at their establishment.
Yeah, I was at that press conference. That was real nice.
They need to do more to provide for their own security. That's been Triple Threat's position for a year now.
I mean, they were so aggressive. I actually thought that they'd say, we'll come to your house and set it up for you. We'll give you a $250 rebate for the first camera, $400 if you get two. $500 for two.
What are the reimbursement levels for gun-sniffing dogs?
Well, we have that on Michigan Avenue right now. Neiman Marcus. Yeah. And they've caught somebody, too. It's actually working. Gun-sniffing dogs.
Of course it's working.
And they got a guy
That's
with
why they have them.
Yeah. Well.
So now if you have a retail establishment in Chicago, you have to set up security like you're an international airport. Mm-hmm. If I had a retail establishment, a gun sniffing dogs, to the extent I could afford it, I have a couple guys with sport rifles out front, too, just to make the point. That's what it's come to. Why has it come to that? Well, you know, for as much talk of love as we hear from the mayor, yeah, there's certainly a situation of family breakdown that needs to be addressed and can never and will never be addressed by government, especially this government in Chicago. But there's also the unconditional love shown by the political class to violent offenders, and that continues. Last year, documented by CWB Chicago, we had more than five dozen individuals who were charged with killing or shooting or trying to shoot or kill someone while awaiting trial for a felony. This year, we already have our 13th person, a man on bail for being a felon in possession of a firearm, shot a woman, and fired toward four other people, including his estranged wife, this past weekend. 13th person charged with killing or shooting or trying to shoot or kill someone while awaiting trial for a felony. And he was a convicted felon to begin with, as per the charge, being a felon in possession of a firearm. So, we can talk round and round and round. If you can't accomplish this simple task, then there's really nothing else to talk about, because it is a leading indicator of how unserious you are about public safety.
But real quick, back to that gun-sniffing dog. I mean, he was spot on. The guy had a loaded 9mm handgun. They sniffed him on the way, and they watched him. He shoved two belts into his waistband, a jacket, all the stuff worth $995. And after they arrested him, they found out that he was on electronic monitoring. So he's just put guns up. Gun-sniffing dogs everywhere, right, Dan? It's working.
I carry a gun because a gun-sniffing dog is too heavy. Tom Hogan served as a federal prosecutor, local prosecutor, elected DA. He's currently in private practice. He joins us now to add to our discussion. Tom, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Glad to see you guys are still hanging in there in Chicago.
Yeah. Well. Hanging in. Thanks to gun-sniffing dogs, we are. Tom, I mean, you look at this nationally, as do we, but our particular focus is in Chicago. This particular aspect of the conversation, the bonding out, putting on electronic monitoring and or bonding out, convicted felons who are looking at additional felony charges and commit felonies while they're awaiting trial. Is this something that is particularly unique to Chicago, or are you seeing this in all the cities that are headed up by Soros-funded DAs?
You're seeing it in all the cities. But what they're doing is they are letting people out who are in the cohort of folks who are most likely to commit homicides. We're talking about people who have prior violence, people who carry guns, people who are involved in drug dealing. Those are the folks, it's not hard to pick them out, who should be locked up pending trial. If you're going to let them out,
they regard bail as simply the cost that they have to pay to go out and commit more crimes.
And if they are, you know, they go out and commit more crimes, maybe this time they'll get away, or this time they'll be able to skip bail and get out of town, or I don't know what the thinking is, but I mean, it's just lunacy from both these district attorneys or state's attorneys and the circuit court judges in these big cities, isn't it?
It is. You know, the judges have not turned over that much. So usually it's a matter of the DAs seeking the appropriate bail, the prosecutor seeking the appropriate bail. Because if the judges are told, you know, that the prosecutors are not seeking high bail, then they're going to go along usually with whatever they're told. And if nobody's asking for the person to be locked up, the defense lawyer is certainly not going to, then that person's going to be set loose.
And with respect to these same big cities, there's a lot of focus on police retirements, and there's a focus on relationship between the mayor and the, you know, the police union, or the mayor and the police chief, depending on which city you're talking about. But at the end of the day, if you as a community refuse to lock up repeat violent offenders, then get used to living in a violent community.
Yeah, and Dan, you've actually named the troika that is the key combination. So it is your mayor, your district attorney, your state's attorney in Illinois, and your police chief. If you have those three people in alignment on law enforcement, you'll have a safe city. If you have any one of them going into left field on public safety, you're going to have an unsafe city. In Chicago, unfortunately, have all three of them going into left field and not protecting the city. That makes it virtually impossible for the citizens of Chicago to feel safe in their day-to-day activities.
Well, it's so weird because I go to these press conferences and David Brown every time says, you know, our electronic monitoring system is broken. We never had this in Dallas. But yet they're too fearful to sit down with the actual people who are making these decisions, i.e. Kim Fox, Tom Dart. And so they just keep, you know, the right hand keeps yelling at the left hand and nothing gets done. And then people end up dying and we'll have the highest homicide rate once again.
Well, actually, you guys are nip and tuck with Philadelphia these days. And Philadelphia suffers from the same problem. The mayor pointing the finger at the DA, the DA pointing the finger at the police. Nobody wants to accept responsibility. And it was funny. I actually was sitting down with four guys who have been convicted of murder and who have served their time. And I asked one of them, what does it take to make things safer in the big cities again? And one of them looked up at me and said, Mr. Hogan, unless you convince people like me that carrying a gun on the street will result in you being locked up, then you're going to keep getting killings in Philadelphia. We meant the same thing about Chicago, L.A., New York.
Well, and in Illinois, under the rubric criminal justice reform, we allow for those on home monitoring to have two free days to roam as they like, and that counts towards their sentences. That's two free days per week.
Oh my God.
So we have a weekend furlough every week for those who are on electronic monitoring because they're alleged to have committed a serious crime and in most cases have previously been convicted of serious crimes.
Yeah, that's not only a get-out-of-jail-free card, that's a get-out-of-jail-free card plus a free couple days to wander around. That is a very unique approach to keeping the public safe.
Isn't it? Yeah, we like to be innovators here. Now, the counterexample, at least rhetorically, and I wonder if you're seeing substantive action behind the rhetoric of newly minted New York City Mayor Eric Adams, because he seems to be, and of course he's former police, he seems to be suggesting that it's time for New York to go back to broken windows model of policing. Is that happening?
Mayor Adams is certainly moving towards having the police being more aggressive in New York. He's reinstated the gun squads, the special jump out squads that focus on possession of guns. The problem that he is running into is one, he's inherited an 8-year mess from Bill de Blasio. And two, he's got some of his own progressive prosecutors. He's got Alvin Bragg in Manhattan.
Right.
The Brooklyn DA is actually, although he was a progressive, he's starting to see where it's heading and starting to change his tune. But the Bronx DA is still a problem. So Mayor Adams has got five different prosecutors to deal with in the five boroughs, and he's got different people responding in different ways. The good news is the police, the 38,000 NYPD police officers, are responding very positively. And he brought in a police chief who is a no-nonsense, tough black woman who is aligned with him. So they're moving in the right direction. Their biggest stumbling block right now is still their prosecutors. And you know what a stumbling block your prosecutor is. Kim mm-hmm. Fox is just pro-criminal.
Mm-hmm. And the other big cities, anybody else beyond some rhetoric, tamping down the defund the police rhetoric? And I guess you don't need to continue to beat that drum when it's unpopular. If you have the retirement rate that you're seeing in all these big cities, you're defunding the police, de facto. But even Ted Wheeler in Portland is saying, you know, there's a certain level of policing we need to keep the city safe. But in Seattle, in Portland, they're still going the way of Chicago and Philadelphia, aren't they?
They absolutely are. If you want a good example of a city that's doing it the right way, San Diego, who is one of the 10 biggest cities in the United States, has a good, no-nonsense prosecutor, Summer Steven. They've got a very good police chief who unfortunately is a year or so from retiring, who understands how to actually come down on violent criminals while not being too punitive on lesser crimes. And they've got a mayor who generally stands out of the way. They have been the exception in the big cities, even though you would think they would have a lot of homelessness because they're in a warm climate.
Yeah.
And you think they'd have a lot of retail theft because there are people running in and out of there in the tourism industry. They don't. They have maintained order because they have the right people in the right place doing the right things.
Well, San Diego is an interesting case study, and it's a case study in something else, too, which is electoral competition. Because I know the mayor now, Todd Gloria, is a Democrat. But as you say, he's standing out of the way, and that's interesting. But it's a city that has voted for Republican mayors in the not-so-recent past. So it's something when you feel like you can only go so far because you can be replaced by the other party. And that's not something that politicians in places like Chicago or L.A. or New York City or Philadelphia feel.
No, I mean, they are strictly one party machines. And the one party machine necessarily means that a small electoral turnout in the primary determines who your winner is going to be. And if people aren't paying attention in the primary, then you're going to end up with somebody who is going to be far left. And I mean, I've spoken about this before. George Soros made a very cost effective investment in these radical prosecutors. Didn't cost him that much, cost him a few million dollars to disrupt all of these cities in the United States. Business has to stand up and do the same thing. It's time for the businesses of Chicago and Philadelphia and New York to invest in prosecutors who are actually going to enforce the law. It'll be good for the business's bottom line, and it'll be good for these cities. They have to put their money where their mouths are at this point.
Yeah, well, there's the fourth problem. You mentioned the other three, the three buckets that need to be filled: the mayor, the police chief, the prosecutor, the community. The fourth bucket, business community, and they have just abdicated in Chicago. And I suspect that's very similar in other cities too, where they understand it's a pay-to-play culture. They don't want to engender the anger of the one-party overlords, and so they, offer some protestation, but what they really do is just go out and get gun sniffing dogs and put up security cameras, and maybe occasionally somebody will break ranks and write an open letter, but that's about it.
Yeah, although I haven't lost optimism yet. I mean, I ran for office two times in a purple county and always won by 20% because I could convince people that doing the right thing was important. In the cities now, you're seeing the Latino communities and the Asian communities start to wake up. And they're starting to look around and going, hold on, I'm not pro-crime. I want my family to be safe. So I am going to start thinking about, are there other options out there? And we're going to have to go back to the bad old days of the 80s and 90s, where there was just rampant crime in every big city before people really catch on. And then even the voters of New York, a classic Democratic city, turned and started to elect people who were, if not Republicans, at least independent, or at least moderate Democrats, and actually managed to turn the city around. Can Chicago do that? I don't know. You have some entrenched corruption issues there. So it's going to take a lot of work.
Yeah, I'd say that
I'll
again.
Be
Tom,
6 feet under before that happens.
Yeah, I'm afraid I will too. Tom Hogan, he former federal prosecutor, local prosecutor, elected DA, as he mentioned. He's currently in private practice, and you can get his writings over at City Journal too. Tom Hogan, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Absolutely, Danny. And keep up the good work.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. It's Putin and inherited Trump impacts that are the cause of the inflation under which we're now suffering. That's the story from the left. Putin and policies inherited by Trump. Well, that's not what economists at the San Francisco Fed found. They write in a recent report, however, or since the first half of 2021, U.S. inflation has increasingly outpaced inflation in other developed countries. Since the first half of 2021, U.S. inflation has increasingly outpaced inflation in other developed countries. So those other developed countries that went through the same funny money spending that we went through in the during the pandemic under Trump. U.S. inflation is outpacing those countries since the first half of 21 under President Biden. Estimates suggest that fiscal support measures designed to counteract the severity of the pandemic's economic effect may have contributed to this divergence by raising inflation about 3 percentage points by the end of 2021. So not only can they not avoid responsibility, meeting the Biden team, lest you forget, as we reminded you in our conversation with Steve Moore earlier this week, that these same individuals, backed by a bunch of leftist economists, were pushing another $2 trillion in funny money spend, saying that it would have no effect short-term on inflation and medium-term would reduce inflation. And then the platform for Biden and Pelosi and, you know, these other mindless socialists to parrot what the economists had agreed to back in terms of a policy position. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say Putin and after effects of Trump and then look at the divergence between the U.S. and other industrialized nations in 2021, combined with saying we're going to double down on those policies, the funny money spending that was done under Trump. It was inflationary when he did it. It's not inflationary when we do it.
I know. They also blame COVID and corporate greed, too, for, you know, sky high gas prices.
For more on all of this, pleased to be joined by Andy Puzder, senior fellow at the Pepperdine University School of Public Policy, former CEO of CKE Restaurants, author of Getting America Back to Work and It's Time to Let America Work Again. By the by, Andy will be speaking at National Review Institute's Creating Opportunity Regional Seminar on April 12th. That would be next week at the University Club in Chicago. You can get details and tickets at NRIinstitute.org. Andy, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Great to be here, Dan and Amy. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. So on the matter of inflation and what the Biden administration has done, tried to do, and is doing.
Well, if you take a look at the at that study that you mentioned out of San Francisco, they actually included a chart that shows that through the Trump administration during the pandemic, our level of inflation was basically consistent with these European countries, these France, Germany, Canada, averaged together. There were seven European nations and Canada that they used in this test. That we were inflation. We were all spending a lot during the pandemic, so that businesses didn't go under and people had money to live while they couldn't work, while businesses were shut down. At the end of 2020, when we were starting to emerge from the pandemic, we really didn't need a further infusion of cash. And in fact, while there were many liberal economists, mostly in the White House, who were pushing for another $1.9 trillion in spending, that was Joe Biden's Save America, the America Rescue Act. While they were pushing for that, there were economists, even on the left, like Larry Summers, who had been the Secretary of the Treasury under Clinton and the head of the Council of Economic Advisors under Biden, Jason Furman, an Obama economist, Steve Rattner, an Obama economist, all saying, if you spend this other $1.9 trillion, it's going to really pour kerosene on an already burning inflationary fire. They ignored that. They said it wasn't going to happen, as you noted. They passed the $1.9 trillion, and in the chart that's in the San Francisco study, you literally can see when they passed the bill, because our inflation rate surges way above anything that these other well-developed nations, economically developed nations, were suffering. And it stayed up there ever since. So they were told this was going to happen. They did it anyway. Then they passed the infrastructure bill with some Republican help, which is further going to add to the amount of money that's being funneled into the country. And they wanted to pass that ridiculous Build Back Better bill on top of the spending that they'd already done, which was driving inflation. So either the Biden administration is intentionally driving inflation, or they have no idea what to do to stop it. And I think it's more likely the latter than the former. But we do need a change of policy. We need a change of policy by this administration, or we're going to be dealing with inflation for a very long time.
And so this against the backdrop of the continued report of, somewhere between 11 and 12 million unfilled jobs, even as we're coming out of the pandemic and we're seeing unemployment decline, if you believe the Labor Department's numbers. So how do you explain those unfilled jobs as the transfer payments have? Well, I shouldn't say stop.
Reduced. Right. Incentives matter. And if you encourage people not to work, they're not going to work. So we've had huge payments during the pandemic. And thanks to President Biden, who really just wanted credit for giving more checks to people after he was elected, when he passed that $1.9 trillion spending bill, the rate of savings is very high. People have a lot of money in the bank. And Biden, while the federal largesse has declined, it hadn't gone away. They very materially increased monthly food stamp payments. And they now, Biden is now forgiving the student loans, which encourage people with college educations who signed agreements to repay these loans. They're now going to be less encouraged to go to work to make those payments because the loans are being forgiven. And going back to Larry Summers again, he said this was absolutely the wrong policy decision, and that it would infuse another $100 billion into our economy, which will further drive inflation. So they just can't get away from these inflationary policies. What they really need to do is look, it's a supply and demand problem, and they need to encourage supply. There aren't enough goods to meet the demand that currently exists because of all the government spending. So there's two things you can do. One is you can increase supply, which is painless. You reduce regulations. On businesses, you reduce taxes, you encourage domestic energy production, all very painless things that should get the economy going. On the other side, if you're going to fight inflation by reducing demand, you stop pouring money into the economy. If you don't do that, what's going to have to happen is the Fed's going to have to step in, and they're going to have to raise interest rates, which is what the Fed is now saying it's going to do, as much as 0.5% the next three quarters. So significant increases in the interest rate to kind of to try and cool demand, cool down the economy. And that is painful. Inflation is something that that Americans experience. It's a tax on working and middle-class Americans. It's a tax you see at the gas pump. You're increasingly seeing it in the grocery store when you go to buy food. And I'll tell you, if we end up with the kind of food shortages that the Biden administration is talking about, that's the time when you find real political change. You look back in history, when there's a famine, you see really meaningful political change. So they really need to change policies here. There's going to be a lot of pain in this country.
And what's the average cost going to be per family or American household? If people are living on a fixed budget, what should they plan for?
Well, Bloomberg came out with some numbers about 2 weeks ago where they said in 2021, inflation had increased costs for the average family by about $5,000 a year, a little over $400 a month. And, you know, for people that are living paycheck to paycheck or people that are trying to recover, that's a lot of money. So I'd imagine this year it's going to be higher. Inflation last year was about 7%. It sits at about 7%. But wholesale inflation, so that's retail inflation, that's 7%. That's what you're paying at the pump and at the grocery store. But wholesale inflation, which is what the people who supply goods to retailers, that inflation is at about 10%. So you could easily see inflation going to double digits this year, which would make it more than $5,000 a year.
Well, you know, and this matter of you know, people have money in the bank because of the transfer payments over the last couple of years. Yeah, but we also see consumer debt spiking up over 11% annually. So if you have an economic downturn, there's a lot of people that are not in a position to weather it. The combination of increased household debt plus increased cost of living.
Well, and plus, you're right. And those savings, while they do have savings, the savings are going down. They're not going up right now. They're going down. And so you're going to end up with a situation where you don't really have the kind of economic growth that we saw coming out of the pandemic. Larry Kudlow and President Trump said we were going to have a V-shaped recovery, and we were having a V-shaped recovery. The Biden kind of fell into the end of that V-shaped recovery, but that recovery is not going to continue if inflation's high and we're increasing interest rates. So you're not going to have all of the jobs that we have out there now. When the economy declines, the number of job openings declines. So people are going to be out of savings, facing significantly higher prices, and they're not going to have the same job opportunities in a year or two that they have now. So I'm hoping that people will realize that if there are jobs out there, they should take them now and not wait to see what's going to happen, because the future right now does not look bright economically, absent significant policy changes by the Biden administration. Again, as I said, just go back to Trump's policies, reduce regulations, reduce taxes, focus on domestic energy production, and we can beat this back. But they can't politically do that. Biden can't do that politically because he's answerable to the far left wing of his party. So we're in for some tough times.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's the thing. The absent policy changes, but there's not the political will to make those policy changes. So, you know, we're polling every person on the show that has passed an Econ 101 course on this, whether or not you think we're at the doorstep of a stagflationary environment.
Well, of course we are. And really, you know, this is so, you know, they make it sound like it's this big complicated problem. Trump caused it, Putin. You know, it's not a complicated problem. Inflation is a result of supply and demand. And if supply is meeting demand, you don't have inflation. We could have tremendous, tremendous demand. But if supply meets it, you don't have inflation. That was the Trump years. We had tremendous demand, but supply was meeting it. Our supply chains were damaged in the pandemic. Demand was significantly increased because we had all these transfer payments, all the money that went out to people. So what we need to do now is tone down demand, but really beef up supply. If you can beef up supply, we can fight this back. But that takes what the Democrats call supply side economics. And if you don't, if you're not willing to support supply side economics, the supply side's not going to respond. We're going to end up with the kind of situation we're facing now, which is ridiculous inflation, which is going to continue absent political change, which hopefully we'll have some of in 2022, and a significant change hopefully in 2024.
On that supply side, if we got better policymakers advancing better policies, what is your handle on where we are in terms of the onshoring that was happening during Trump continuing such that we would have more American manufacturing capacity and capacity in other sectors if and when we had policymakers who wanted to unleash the productive capacity of America.
Yeah, this is a real switch that's happened and happened a little bit before the pandemic, but certainly more during the pandemic, where countries across the globe are realizing that globalization had significant downsides and significant risks. And when we have problems in countries like the Ukraine, or when we have problems with countries such as Russia and China, that globalization puts us at risk because we depend on those countries for various supplies, various raw materials, and various manufactured goods. So there's been a real push to try and increase our domestic capacity to deal with these issues. So there's at least some capacity if we face a problem. Trump tried to do this with the steel, manufacturing of steel and aluminum. Biden has cut back on that somewhat. But we do need to make sure that when we have an emergency worldwide, the United States isn't stuck in a position where it can't meet its own needs. Other countries are realizing that as well. So I think we're going to see a increased nationalism and increased reliance on the resources of individual countries rather than on globalization. And I think it has to happen. I mean, the world right now is suffering from an energy crisis and soon suffering from the food crisis, all based on what's going on with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I think people are coming to realize that this is a very significant problem. We may have been misled for the past 30, 40 years about the need for globalization, the importance of it, and how risk-free it was. It's not risk-free, and we need to protect ourselves. So there is going to be a significant change in how people deal with producing goods domestically as opposed to relying solely on international markets.
He is Andy Pudster, senior fellow at the Pepperdine University School of Public Policy, former CEO of CKE Restaurants, author of the books Getting America Back to Work and It's Time to Let America Work Again. And if you want to catch Andy in person, he'll be speaking in Chicago next week at National Review Institute's Creating Opportunity Regional Seminar. That's April 12th, University Club in, downtown. And you get tickets and details at nriinstitute.org. Andy, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks, Amy. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now!
Yeah, it's time for Open Mic Friday. Taking your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Comments, compliments, criticisms, general crack pottery. We'll take it all. We've already got a full bank of callers, so be patient. Keep calling. We'll try to get to as many as we can. Amy, I know you're bursting at the seams to tell us all about Dr. Arwadi's latest pronouncements.
Well, here's the deal. After locking us down, so, you know, stay away from people, don't socialize, now she's back out there encouraging us to socialize and to make appointments, you know, see these things called friends and family.
A lot of people are worried. I know that. And I want you to hear that I am as concerned about how we recover from COVID related to our mental health as I am our physical health. And so I want to remind you that life is better with other people in it.
Got it, Dan.
And at this point, when COVID risk is relatively low, I really do want to encourage you to be making some of those social connections again, if you have not. I want to encourage you to be leaving your home. I want to be encouraging you to get some of those social connections going again, because we know it's one of the easiest things that you can do to help with your mental health.
Who cares? Like, I want social connections with people that need to be told to make social connections by some city public health director.
I'm just saying that they brainwash people so long for two plus years that there's that's a concern right now, that people are stuck in their homes. Also a concern. Now we have 300 cases a day. Well, what happens normally when you have 300 cases a day? You mask up. But she said this 300 cases a day is different. And here's why.
impact. So if I had to guess, you know, April is going to be a month for the most part of continued slow increase. And if we see signs of any concern, of course, we will be out and notifying people. But I need folks to understand that the increase in cases is not the only thing that we are looking at.
Oh, now they're looking at
200, 300 cases a day. Means something very different than it did before we had vaccine. It also 200, 300, 400, 500 cases a day means something very different from last summer when we were testing a third as much as we are now.
And the bottom line is hospitalizations. Guess how many people are in the hospital? 7 in all of Chicago with COVID. And we have 0 deaths.
So,
but the thing is that everyone, you know, that press conference, oh my God, well, we're at 300 cases. And you told us, you said that if we hit 300 cases, we'll have to remask. No, now they're changing the rules again.
So here's the good news front, as opposed to listening to these, you know, COVIDians, you know, recast their views on all these topics. The good news is that there's a lot of people that can't wait to get to the ballot box to make their opinions known. And perhaps we have a few more canaries in the coal mine, like Glenn Youngkin in Virginia, this time up in Wisconsin, just north of the Cheddar Curtain. In Waukesha, three Waukesha school incumbents lost their seats.
Wow.
And they lost their seats based on COVIDian policies. Even though it was a nonpartisan race, the challengers who were victorious were essentially running on national Republican talking points. In addition to that, for the first time in decades, the Kenosha County executive is a Republican. In Norman, Oklahoma, home of the University of Oklahoma, so one of the few towns that leans left because it's a college town, the incumbent mayor there, Bria Clark, lost the election, again, nonpartisan, but Bria Clark was someone who said proudly, "We were the first to put a mask mandate in place and the last to remove it." She also had moved to cut police funding during the riots of the summer of 2020. She gone.
Good.
So the parental, I would call it the parental rebellion, because I think that's what's still driving it, is very much underreported by the D.C. press corps for obvious reasons. Don't want to give it any more momentum than it has. But it's very real and being felt around the country. We'll see if it comes to Chicago and Illinois, probably the last place it will. But it is very real in places where there still is a preponderance of commonsensical folks.
Oh, my gosh. Justin told me about this. I just looked it up. Philadelphia, their indoor mask mandate is likely to return next week because their COVID cases are creeping upward.
Well, I mean, that's big blue city America.
Big blue city, there you go.
Tony Southside.
Good morning, Amy Lamb and Dan the Professor. Hey, listen, you know, you said you had talked about a shooting in Chicago in the last several episodes there. Anyway, what I wanted to point out was that I heard that the guy was shooting at his wife, and maybe Long Dong Lightfoot is onto something, because obviously the man needs love if he's shooting at his wife. So, and I'd also probably argue this is another reason why Dan Proft is single. That's all I got to say. You guys have a great weekend.
Thanks for the call, Tony.
Speaking of Long Dong Lightfoot, she's in Washington, D.C., celebrating the confirmation of KBJ.
Great. I hope she and Mitt Romney have time for a nice dinner.
No, that's a super spreader event. How could they have this? Everybody in D.C.'s got COVID right now. Nancy Pelosi kissed Joe Biden. Joe Biden hugged Barack Obama, who was with students yesterday at Hyde Park Academy.
Where did she kiss him?
Oh, on the cheek.
Kevin in Austin, Texas.
I see what you did.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. And we talked about the Kenosha thing. And then I'll get to my other point. But it's how they did it, partly, is because people got involved in the local level, the precinct level. I hope you guys have somebody to talk about that soon on the show. The other thing is, when you're talking about stagflation, I got a thing you can refer to that might help you remember. It's called the Randy Buck economy. Because what does a Randy Buck do? It screws your dough.
Pretty good. Thanks for the call, Kevin. Tom in Blue Island. It is Masters weekend.
Dan and Amy, good morning. Two quick things for you. I wonder if Arwadi could give the former President Barack Obama interpersonal relationship advice on how to speak with a current president, number one. And number two, Dan, I have a question for you in relationship to Phil Mickelson in the majors. Do you, or in the Masters, do you believe he's being canceled for failing to be, you know, obsequious to the PGA Tour? I don't trust the reporting I've read on it, and I've been looking to get your opinion on that this week, buddy.
Bye. Well, thanks for the call, Tom. Appreciate it. I mean, Mickelson canceled himself, as far as I'm concerned. He was essentially asked not to come to the Masters by Augusta. Yeah, I mean, and it was because of his affiliation with that Saudi Arabian tour and, you know, the controversy he walked into when he broke bad on this tour to which he was affiliated, because he broke bad on the Saudi family, bad guys, killed Khashoggi, so on and so forth. And then there, the PGA had a moment with the next generation of stars, the Justin Thomases and the Jordan Spieths of the world, and basically said, make a choice, PGA or Saudis. You go with Norman or Mickelson, or you stick with us, and they all stuck with the PGA. Yeah, I have no sympathy for Mickelson on this. And will it be interesting to see if he even shows up at the PGA to defend his title. But he did this himself. And the bigger question to me, which we explored a couple weeks ago when this first bubbled to the surface, why was Mickelson aligning with the Saudi Arabian tour in the first place? It makes no sense. He says it's about leveraging the PGA for better treatment and bigger purses for the players. Yeah, I'm not buying that. And by the way, a lot of the stars of the PGA Tour aren't buying it either. And I talked to a golf reporter who's covered the professional golf for a long time. And he's like, look, he's like, if a lot of these guys have real resentment towards Phil. He's sort of a phony golden boy. He had the insider trading thing where he skated, but, you know, perhaps shouldn't have. And regardless, what is he doing engaged in some insider trading scheme where somebody did go to jail, the instigator of the insider trading? And now this Saudi Arabian thing, it's all very curious. But I don't have a problem at all with Augusta effectively disinviting Phil from playing in the Masters or the PGA shunning him. He's made his choice. I mean, Greg Norman, who's over there too, who's awful, always been awful. Greg Norman, remember his defense of his involvement with the Saudis per their human rights record? What did he say? He said, well, look at America and the racism in America. You know, they got real problems, too. Comparing America to MBS and the Saudis. Are you kidding me? The Islamo fascists in Saudi Arabia.
They just recently let women drive.
Yeah. You know, it'd be one thing if they said, look, that just focus on the sports. If he said, like, oh, it's a competitor and this will provide more opportunity to more golfers and so on and so forth. If they would have just stayed in their lane. But both of them decided to make political statements, and so they can suffer the repercussions from those statements and their decisions. Elliot and Wilmette.
Hey, guys. Hey, Amy and Dan, how you doing? Your 7:30 guest reminded me to pull this invitation out of the trash, an invitation to an event called Abolitionists in Action. Transformative Justice and the University. I forwarded this email to you, but just the first sentence. If abolition demands a world without police, prisons, or punishment, transformative justice is the organized effort to imagine and enact the structures that will take their place.
Who's the keynote speaker, Kim Fox?
No, it's other folks. I forwarded this to you, so maybe you can amplify it.
So this is a local. This is a local defund the police, decarcerate the prisons organization.
Yeah, it's an Eventbrite meeting, and for all us North Shore folk. Also, I wanted to.
Of course, it's on the North Shore.
You pointed out earlier in the week that they were going to rerun Biden in 24, or that they were not going to rerun him, and I decided that they would absolutely put him up again in 2024. It's only because they haven't got anybody older.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the call, Elliot. They got Bernie. Tom in Palos Heights.
Good morning, Dean, Amy. Just got a question for you. I would like you to verify this for me. I heard on the radio the other day that this new Supreme Court justice cannot judge on any women cases at all because she doesn't know what a woman is. She can't identify it. Is that correct?
She did have problems, thanks for the call, Tom, when Marsha Blackburn, Senator Blackburn, asked her to define a woman. She that was a stumper for KBJ. Yeah. I always like a little artistic offering in Open Mic Friday. Bob in Naperville.
Yes, I'm going back 3 or 4 weeks about the trustee in Lyle who didn't like the mayor's comment. What if the duck identifies as a chicken? So bear with me. I'll be brief.
Okay.
There was a trustee from Lyle whose post-meeting face bore no smile. A mayor he spoke, meaning to joke, in terms that were quite not yet woke. A duck is a chicken, a pig is a cow. In this upside-down world, it's all possible now. 8 minutes in, 8 minutes on Twitter, in a tone quite bitter. No doubt this trustee is one heck of a knitter. Sergeant Hulka chimed in with a lighten up Francis, hoping trustee would come to her senses. Suggestions were made. To DeKalb we must go, with Mayor Peacock a likely no-show. The best way to end this needless bout is to vote this knucklehead trustee out. Great show. I love your guest.
Very good.
We love you.
Bob.
Good job.
Nice nice prose. Thank you for that. George, Hoffman Estates.
Great morning, Amy and Dan. Pleasure to be on with you again. Hey, a quick item on the transgender issue that we have. I think we're being a little bit too hard on this situation. Hear me out, please. Listen, we look at rights of everybody here in the United States, and everyone has the right to do things. I support the rights of transgenders to compete in sports. However, we need to have a separate division for them, whether it be high school, grammar school, college, pro sports, the transgender games, Olympics if they like. Let's just set a whole separate division for them. And sports are based upon the people who believe they want to watch them and how popular they are. So let them then survive on their own merits. All right? So let's create a separate a transgender part of it, et cetera, and let them be part of that program. I think that would solve it for it. We are honoring the rights as we do give here in America, and let's see how well they can survive.
All right, thanks for the call, George. Yeah. Ward, don't you think you're being too hard on the beaver? John,
classic line.
John Bridgeport.
Words
yeah,
change.
Hi, guys. Hey, listen, on the People magazine this week, yeah, I found a copy of it, but they're talking about the faces of the fentanyl epidemic. So there's basically 100, and they're all young, that have died from fentanyl, and then some of the parents commenting about how it happened. So basically, why aren't the Republicans speaking up and people with guts about the border and how much of it's coming across there? We don't even know. And it's taking out 100,000 people a year, and most of them are young in that.
Thanks, Sean. So appreciate it. Ryan, New Lenox.
Hey, Dan and Amy, thanks for taking my call. Welcome to an Open Mic Friday, unlike any other, this Masters edition of This Week in Golf with Dan Prof.
I need the birds chirping, and we need some magnolia trees, yeah.
Absolutely. This is my best Jim Nance impression. Very, yeah. Very soft voice here.
Yeah, yeah.
But, Dan, I know Jeannie Ives at the roast said the only time you were wrong is that time you thought you made a mistake. However,
correct.
I would just like to call out you were over on Tiger Woods yesterday, and I thought you could just take this opportunity on today's edition of This Week in Golf with Dan Prof to say you were wrong.
Come on, Dan.
Yeah.
You were
Well, I did. Thanks for the call, Ryan. I did. We started the show mentioning Tiger's great performance yesterday, rising to the occasion. And I said yesterday, you know, I hate betting against Tiger, but if I had to bet just because of, you know, his injury and not playing competitive golf for 15 months, you had to think he'd be 3 over at least yesterday. And, you know, that's why he's Tiger. So, yeah. I know. I didn't bet it, but if I had to, I would have taken the over,
okay. And
he was under. There's no question about it. Thanks for the call, Ryan. And Jeannie Ives also was mean at the She criticized my golf game.
She
only I am allowed to criticize my golf game.
Okay.
John in Libertyville.
Good morning, guys. I'd like to recommend a rock video for you and the listeners. It's by Kid Rock. It's been out about 2 weeks, and he's venting his feelings about our current political experts we have in Washington. Pretty funny. Can't put it on the air, but it's very interesting. Oh,
yeah,
you did?
We have played it. It had to be heavily bleeped, but, yeah, we did play it.
Right there.
But, there you go, John. Instant request. Thanks for the call. All right. Chuck and Delavan to close it out.
Last but not least. Yeah.
Hey, how you doing? That guy from Naperville is a poet, and he doesn't even know it. I can tell by his size that he's Longfellow. Hey, triple crown for me this week. I worked at Pat's Brew and Q putting up siding and sharing. Then I worked at Magpies yesterday putting a roof on. And now my buddy's got the contract to frame Freddy's West End, which they knocked down. And so I'm like a hat trick guy. I got a hat trick going for me, and I'm working in bars, and it's great. I don't have to go, you know, far when I on my way home for cocktail hour.
This is why there's so many people out of work, because you're doing all of the work, Chuck.
That's true. I do everything. I do roofing. I do siding. I do concrete. I do brickwork. I do everything. Don't make no difference. And I pig farm in between.
And
so
you're Santa.
Really good.
And you make a mean Santa. Yep. I mean a happy Santa.
Yep, I try my best to do that. I want everybody to go out and have a fun weekend this weekend, even though it's been gloomy. Get out and party and do stuff and enjoy yourself. Fish fry tonight at the Butterfly out on Route 43. That's where I'm going to be. So,
all right.
Anyway.
All right. Do what
Chuck
said.
Thanks for all the name dropping.
Thanks for the call, Chuck. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.